for half the world's population. They live in a building that doesn't have a physical address, no building name, no road name.
There's always a point where you decide to build, where it goes from idea to an actual act. So what was it for you?
As long as the problem is still there and it's not solved, this business needs to exist.
One thing I'm always curious about is that first institutional money that you take in. How was that for you?
One of the most insightful moments was observing the Red Cross ambulance service. She said, "I got so lost yesterday that I arrived too late and the person was dead."
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Startup Leap. Today we have an incredible guest in the house who is rethinking smart addressing for emerging markets. 90% of the world, the population, is covered by Google Maps, but you still have 4 billion people without a formal addressing system. Mm-hmm. To me, that data is just very insane. And our guest today, Timbo, is changing that. And he brings an incredible experience as an operator, a product manager. So welcome, Timbo. It's great to have you.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Yeah, it's very excited to have you with us today.
Fantastic. Very quickly into it. You started OK High quite a while ago.
Yeah.
About 10 years now. Did you predict, like, what eventually happened? Was it what you thought would happen?
You mean where we are today?
Yes.
Definitely not.
I feel like no one says yes. But tell us a little bit about the point you decided that you wanted to build this.
Yeah. I think, by the way, like, naivety is a great driver of entrepreneurship. So, worked at Google for many years, based between London and the US, and I led the launch of Google Maps across Europe, Middle East and Africa, which is, like the stats that you said, was just mind-blowing to me. It was actually only when I took a sabbatical, I was going to move full-time to the US, and I traveled between East and West Africa for 3 months, and I experienced the problem firsthand, which is very different to when you're just sitting behind a computer and you see these stats. And I saw how difficult it was to find places or people to get to me, how difficult it was to get a SIM card and prove my address. And I was like, this is insane that this is a problem to this magnitude in the world today. And that was really the real inflection point where I started getting, my obsession started, let's just say.
I love it. There's always, I think, a point where you decide to build something, where it goes from idea to an actual act. So what was it for you? You had seen the problem, and then what happened? How did OK High come about?
Yeah, so I mean, it was a difficult decision. I had the opportunity, and what I was supposed to do, which was move to San Francisco, lead Chromecast and Google's dual screen efforts, which is what I was doing. Basically become like a tech bro in Silicon Valley. And suddenly, on the other hand, I'm now experiencing this problem and seeing that there was something that I was starting to getting really interested in. And as I said, the obsession started. And I think there was a few things going on at that time. One was I knew that it was a low risk time for me to take the leap into entrepreneurship, to leave the sort of comfort blanket of Google, because I was young, I didn't have dependencies, etc. Secondly, I thought that San Francisco is an amazing city that I like, but it's also very similar to London and other developed markets where I spend lots of time. And I was loving being in a completely different part of the world and kind of very enamored by the people, the problems, the culture. And I was like, I've got this opportunity to make and experience life in a very different way. And so that was another catalyst. And then I think the third was seeing the tech communities that were building up at that time. So it was 2013, 2014. Both in Kenya and Nigeria, there was some leading tech hubs, but I could see that there was a community of people that I could be part of. So quite, I'd say, scary, quite honestly, to kind of just leave everything and move to a country where I didn't know anyone. But there was this tech community that would kind of enabled it to be a slightly soft landing. So I think when I saw those three things in place, I was like, let's just do it.
And how did you immerse yourself within that? Obviously, it was a new market for you. There was this tech community, as you mentioned, but in terms of the problem, slightly removed from what you were doing at Google, similar space, very different in terms of context. How did you immerse yourself and get an understanding of the market?
I went deep. You know, I thought it was very important that I tried to go in and really understand and validate the problem. So I had a startup that I ran on the side while I was at Google. It failed beautifully. That's another story.
Yeah.
But was that part of Google or was it completely separate?
It was completely separate.
Okay, cool.
It was on the side. It was called Group Gifts. And the idea was to group money between friends to buy a better gift for someone's birthday. Mm. One of my main learnings, when we spent 2 years working on this solution and we were ready to launch what was going to be a massive fanfare, ironically, on November the 5th. And guess what? Like, tumbleweed. Literally. And one of my main learnings was that, was like, you have to fundamentally, obviously, get behind the problem and understand it. And I read The Lean Startup afterwards, and it was a bit of an aha moment.
Uh-huh.
I was
like, in reverse.
I should have read this 2 years ago, but at least I'm reading it now. Mm. I spent the first 6 months just talking to people to validate the problem. One of the most insightful moments was observing the Red Cross Ambulance Service in Kenya, talking to drivers, and a driver came back and I was talking to her and she said, I got so lost yesterday trying to find someone that I arrived too late and the person was dead. And I was like, holy crap, yeah. Like that's like a great validation of the problem.
Yeah, if it's not solved.
Exactly. And I spoke to over 200 businesses and it enabled me not only to better understand the problem and where there were pain points, but it also enabled me to like build a community. And through that, people were very, you know, forward in terms of making introductions, but I met people who became friends, who became potential customers. And it was a great way to kind of dive into the initial throes of building a business.
So it sounds like the customers almost came before the product in your journey of discovery.
100%, yeah.
How did you go about productizing this and building a team around the idea that you had?
So let's start with the team, because that was really important to me. I was going through this whole research phase. I was also on the lookout for people who perhaps are as mad as me to kind of solve this problem. And through that process, through introductions or people I just happened to meet on a startup bootcamp weekend or whatever, found three other people, Nav, Wes, and Evans, who seemed equally excited about the problem. And we started setting out on then, to your point, how can we kind of start testing this? And I used literally the Lean Startup manual. Mm. And I felt I'd validated the problem. The next stage was like validating the solution. And we did it without building anything. And we went, you know, with sort of mocks and to customers saying, would you want to use this if we built this? And there's good validation. So we then went out and built our early prototypes. And at that time, also a friend from the UK came out for a few months, Henry, and he joined the team. So we had five people, three in sort of product, one engineering and designer and me. And we just started prototyping. You know, we work with customers, we put Android devices in the pockets of delivery drivers, in ambulances. We started tracking their movement to see that there was a problem and started, you know, creating a solution to try and solve it. And we got really good early validation that what we were doing was a real problem, that we're solving it in the right way. It was an interesting journey. We lost some of these mobile phones. I say lost, quote unquote. Especially with the ambulance services, surprisingly. But it was a small price to pay for the learnings that we got.
Interesting. I would love to talk about the infrastructure that existed at the time, which I guess is the problem you're trying to solve, but also you need it for the solution. And I'll explain. This was 2014 when you started OKHi. Mm. You are trying to solve a behemoth of a problem of precise addressing, but you also need to rely on existing technologies to be able to give you the data. Could you talk a little bit about the problem statement at the time and how you tackled that and how the tech infrastructure has evolved beyond that?
Sure. So the problem fundamentally is that for half the world's population, they live in a building that doesn't have a formal physical address. There's no building name, there's no road name. They often have to use a set of directions to be able to get somewhere. A delivery business that's trying to get to that person will often have to use a few phone calls to find them. If you are a bank and you're trying to verify that address, you might have to send someone physically to verify it. And so it all comes down to the fact that this individual doesn't have an easy way to describe where they live. At the time, from a technology perspective, I was like, all the technology is here to solve it. There is smartphones, there is connectivity, there is a Google Maps layer. And, you know, incidentally, actually, fundamentally, not much has really changed in 10 years around those fundamentals. They've got better, more people have access to it. But fundamentally, those building blocks were there. I think one of the key insights that I had while at Google and why this, you know, we talk about Google Maps working, was that Google Maps is brilliant at mapping places. So businesses, you can find on Google Maps. Buildings that have an address, you can find on Google Maps. But people, you can't, especially if they don't have an address. And so the whole premise of building OK High was focused on addressing people, not places. And our mission as a business has been very focused on that. It's all about putting 1 billion people on the map.
I love that. Sidebar, OK High. What was that brainstorming session that led to this name?
Do you want the
investor
response or
the
real response?
We want
the real
response.
I'll give you the investor response first.
Okay.
We were looking for a name that could work in any language in the world, right? I really like the fact that there were names of companies that didn't really mean anything because you can kind of own that brand. And if there are any two English words people know in any country in the world, it's OK High. Additionally to that, OKHigh.com was pretty much free domain. There's an interesting story there. And you put it into Google and it was kind of gobbledygook. So we could just own all the organic search. How it came about was, in fact, someone who I was house-sitting with at the time, who ended up being an investor, who's also an entrepreneur, we were brainstorming names on like a Saturday night, and I was coming up with really like literal boring names.
Give us a few that made it to the short list.
I don't know, you know, like pin it and like really sort of boring
on
literal
the nose.
Names. Yeah, exactly. And he went out and I got a call from him later that night from a bar, and he's like, I've got a name for you. And he's like, and I was like, go for it. He's like, OK, hi. And I'm like, I don't know where that's come from, but I like it. Monday, go back to the team. I'm like, I've got a name. I spent so long with the group gifts business, worrying about the name and the brand, which obviously became completely negligible and useless in the grand scheme of things. I was like, we're not going to spend any time worrying about this at this point. We just need something to refer to ourselves. If it works and it sticks, then great. If it doesn't, we can change it. And so that was how
that's
it happened.
Interesting.
Yeah. But there's a funny story with the domain. So I went onto the Whois search and found that it was owned by this guy that lived in North London. And so it was like, I remember really clearly, it was about 7 p.m. We were working out the garage of the house in Nairobi, as any good startup. And I called up this guy and I told him what we're doing. And he was charging, you know, a couple of thousand dollars for it. And especially at that time, it was a lot of money. So I basically pitched to him, OK, hi. And after it, he was like, you know what? You can have the domain for free. I was like, yes. He's like, but I want equity.
Oh,
and
wow.
I was like,
oh,
yes.
Smart
guy though. I was just like, kudos to you.
We're not even set up for this. We don't even have like a registered company yet. And so
smart strategy though.
It was very smart. These domain, you know, sitters.
Yeah, really, this is their strategy.
Exactly. So didn't give him equity. Next day, you know, the $2,000 was now $3,000, by the way.
Whoa.
But managed to get a decent price for a
so funny.
Four-letter domain, which we now own. It was a good price to pay.
Speaking of equity, one thing I'm always curious about is that first institutional money that you take in. How was that for you, particularly at a time where, you know, Google Maps was obviously, you know, very well rolled out across the world, but then you obviously have these pockets within countries where there's still this issue, right? So just curious how it was, you know, explaining that to institutions. What was that experience like for you at the time?
I think it's still a journey to try and explain it.
Yeah.
You know, there's two groups. There's people who have lived or spent a lot of time in emerging markets, and you don't really have to explain it. People get it immediately. And then there are people who've lived in developed markets who you have to explain it. But if you do it right, they see that you see the aha moment, because they're like, I never thought about that this is a problem. I can't believe this is a problem. And I think generally it was storytelling, as it always is. I think it was storytelling about myself, which I'm not naturally very good at, but sort of continuing to learn is a growth space for me. And ultimately, you know, selling people into the vision that I and we have. I think it was very helpful to have a clear mission, and it's probably one of the most important pieces of infrastructure for the company that we developed. A very clear mission, a reason why the company exists, and almost everything kind of falls from that. So, yeah, but we're continuing to iterate on that.
So I think storytelling, the ability to storytell all stages of business is absolutely key, right? But just curious, like in hindsight, in that first institutional raise, is there anything that you would have done differently?
I look back at the decks that I wrote in the early days.
Do you cringe?
I do cringe. But I think in the early rounds, I was very focused on bringing like the best people I could find into the company.
How do you define
People who could deliver value to the company. I had like three criteria. One was that they had experience building a technology business. Second, that they had experience in emerging markets, especially like Kenya and Africa, where I was focused on.
Are these talent or like investors? In terms of how you optimized for who joined you on the company, is this on the storytelling piece? Is this criteria you're mentioning now? Did you apply that to the people you brought on as co-founders and early team, or investors, or maybe it's across both as well?
I think it's a different criteria.
Okay.
So this is very much like people who could deliver
build the experience business with you.
The third one was experience in like geo and mapping.
Okay.
And I didn't need all three, but if people ticked, you know, two of the boxes, whatever. And to the extent that I would potentially slow down the speed of raising money to get that. And we brought brilliant investors on board. So I was like, we are, you know, in a great place. The reality is that these brilliant investors have, and most of them were angels, have, you know, busy lives. They have their own day job, and we're part of many portfolio businesses, and you have to put a lot of time and effort to extract from them. And I think I overemphasized the value that these people would bring. And some have been brilliant, some I haven't heard of, and that's okay. But I think I thought that they were going to deliver, all going to deliver a lot more value than they did.
And on the talent side, you mentioned your co-founders. What was that conversation like?
Yeah, we did a trial.
Yeah.
Because it was easy for me. This was the path I was taking, and I'd already quit my job.
Yeah.
Others were either working on their own business or had other ties. So I said to everyone, let's work together for 6 weeks. Let's both validate the problem by tracking these drivers, etc. And let's see if we can get validation of the solution. So that one, you can get a better signal whether this is a problem and a solution that you think is worth, you know, betting on. And two, we can experience like what it's like. And by the way, if after 6 weeks, we should kind of expect that this isn't going to work and we can walk away. And the reality is that we all got on really well, very different characters, very different strengths. We all got on really well. And like 10 years later, that is still the case. So it's interesting that you can get that signal in really just a matter of weeks.
Yeah.
And turns out that it's still a problem. And it turns out that we're still figuring out the solution.
Yeah.
But it was a very key space to do a trial. And I do like the idea of setting up the expectations and making it easy for it not to work. Reid Hoffman has this great sort of concept in and around hiring, these tours of duty. The default is you come for 2 years, and at the end of that tour of duty, you stop. And that makes everyone more accountable.
Yeah.
It means you're both driving towards these goals, and at the end of it, if it's not working, it's fine.
Yeah.
But it also makes it like you're driving along aligned incentives to kind of make it work. Mm. And so that worked really well.
In terms of product, building for the last 9 years into 10 right now, I'm trying to understand what the journey has been like for you, because it's a very specific problem, also very painful.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there's external factors which are harder to control, but it's a lot around timing.
Yeah,
we were very early.
Yeah,
and as much as that tech infrastructure we talked about in terms of smartphones and geo maps, etc., they're being there. For example, people thought that they would be charged if they had their GPS turned on at that time. You know, that's how kind of like new things were.
Mm.
Mapping literacy was relatively low, especially in a market like Kenya, and people weren't really used to looking at maps from a bird's eye view.
Mm.
You know, the advent of like Uber, for example, totally helped educate the market, and that helped us. At the beginning, we basically would organize these treasure hunts to figure out with these delivery drivers that we hired, what was the best way to describe a location digitally.
Mm-hmm.
And we would see if they actually managed to reach the different points of the treasure hunt. We would track them, see if they were getting lost on the way.
Mm-hmm.
And we would try all these different ways of a digital address. And one of the things we found was that while the GPS is core to getting close, it's not good enough. And a photo of the property really helps drive the accuracy. At that time, Google Street View didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And we went out and then walked the streets with students to take photos of 20,000 buildings in Nairobi so that we could go lean and build the data set to verify that this actually worked. And it did, you know, it worked really well. And by the time that we were starting to then properly productize it, Google came in with Google Street View, which we knew would come at some point, and then we were able to leverage that.
Mm.
So part of it is around timing.
Mm.
And the second thing, I think we took this very customer-centric approach, very user-centric. We were constantly doing user research studies, constantly looking at, not so much at data, because we didn't have too much of it, given the users. And we would, you know, basically go through a number of different iterations to build this, you know, product and service.
Yeah.
And we initially tried it with consumers, worked really well. They wanted to use it with delivery businesses. We then went with delivery businesses. That really worked really well, but we struggled to make a lot of money out of that with positive unit economics. So then we went to financial services, and that's really where we are today, which is where we're seeing a real explosive growth, especially in Nigeria, where the problem is even more acute than we saw in Kenya.
Do you paint the picture of the ICP there and, you know, what the use case is for our listeners?
So the ideal customer profile is a fintech business or a bank in Nigeria. We're generally selling to the chief commercial or risk officer. And the problem that they have is that the regulation requires them to know where the customers are. They have to do proof of address. This is a global requirement
under
KYC and AML anti-money laundering rules. The problem is, without a formal address, that's really difficult. And either they do nothing and they face fines from the central bank and potentially even get arrested, or they pay for a service to send a physical agent to the door, which has its own challenges. It's inaccurate, it's expensive.
Doesn't scale.
And it doesn't scale. And when you've got these fintechs that is happening, especially in Nigeria, that are onboarding hundreds of thousands of users a month, there is no way that the solution can scale both financially or practically. So we sell them a way to digitally verify their address. It's a product that sits inside their mobile app, and it uses location data in the phone in a privacy-sensitive way to verify that the person does live where they say they do.
Mm-hmm.
And we have lots of advanced behavioral science and AI, fundamental AI models, to be able to accurately verify that the person lives there. It's the first in the world, and that's probably a whole new topic, which is like educating and creating a new category of business is incredibly exciting and interesting, but it's also very challenging.
Yeah. You mentioned AI data science. I'm just curious, you know, back when you started out, 2013, 2014, technology has changed significantly since then. How have you and your team stayed at the forefront of all these innovations and changes that have come out within the technology stack?
That's the easy part. I mean, we're geeks.
Yeah.
We love it. And so I think as a founding team, the majority are quite technical. Mm-hmm. I'd say almost the antithesis is probably more important. Like, how do you not...
How do you stay focused?
How do you not get distracted by all the bells and whistles of what things could do and make sure that you're fundamentally solving the problem for your customer, even if it doesn't scale, right? Y Combinator has a very good strap line, right? Which is do things that don't scale. I think we proved that well when we were taking photographs and doing that very manually. I do think that there are ways that we could have entered the Nigerian market and probably done more manual verifications to learn and build up that piece of the business. So I think it's a constant space, actually, that we have to be very cognitive of not jumping on the technology as a solution. And in the case of using AI, we actually built our CTO built a sort of human-driven algorithm to do the initial verification. But we saw it had shortcomings.
Yeah.
And we saw that AI could then improve that, and that's when we, you know, then invested in it.
How big is the team today?
We are 13 full-time.
I'd love to talk about the business model and how it evolved, because you said you started with consumer, and then now you're seeing this explosive growth in the financial services KYC addressing stack. Consumer products are expensive to build and run, and I'm just imagining like your tech costs when you were trying to build this in the initial stages, and how difficult it must have been to try to monetize this from a direct-to-consumer perspective and scaling that meaningfully if you think about CAC and LTV and all of that. How did you make the transition on figuring out a business model? I ask this because, especially if you're building in a space that is a market creation type play, you're figuring out a lot. You're figuring out what does this look like as a solution because you've nailed the problem. But then beyond the solution, what does this look like as a business model that scales and works in a market that's consistently like evolving? So talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I think when we were doing the consumer side, it was very much not driven to drive revenue or the business side. It was very much like, we need people to use this digital address that we've now sort of tested with our treasure hunts, but we now need to kind of check that this can actually work on the consumer side. So it was a purposeful phase and a stepping stone, which provided a validation of a hypothesis that we had that then enabled us to move to the next hypothesis, which was that we can ultimately generate money through businesses. You know, you're right. There isn't any playing field where we can say, oh, this is, you know, a payment business or this exists in another country in the world and therefore we can use this payment model. And so fundamentally, I think the most important thing is to find those early businesses that you're working with, that one, you're solving a problem, and two, seeing that solution work. I think it's critical to be building a strong relationship with those early customers, because what we would do is then sit down with the customers and just figure out the win-win, right? Like, we're delivering value. So firstly, let's quantify that value and see if we can tie this to, you know, revenue and actual dollar impact on your business. Secondly, you know, we need to drive revenue and charge for this. So what is the win-win? Mm. Where is the value being delivered? And therefore, how can we charge and monetize at that point of value? Mm. And so in the digital address verification space, we charge when we deliver a verified address. Mm. Part of the magic is that we don't charge when we basically don't verify the address.
Yeah, so the incentives are aligned. To
whereas in physical, they have to charge whether it was verified or not, because they have this cost, large cost of sending a human. And that, to your point, doesn't align incentives. So there's some things where the technology allows us, even though we take a little bit more of that cost, it's a much better model for the customer. As long as you're very focused on that and have the right relationships with the right people who are proactive and kind of forthcoming in that, then you can figure it out.
How do you kind of get investors to get that this is a longer term play that actually requires you deeply understanding the customer because of the nature of the market creation potential of what you're trying to build. How did you navigate that? Were there any specific instances that it came up in certain rounds or any experiences that you could share for the benefits of our listeners? Because I imagine that there are people probably thinking about building in spaces that technically don't have markets yet and they believe it's there.
Well, firstly, anyone that's considering that. Well, firstly, anyone that's considering that, it's a journey. So like, don't expect to have these 3-4 year, you know, exits and returns like you might read about. And to your point, some of these really big businesses take a long time to find product market fit. And I think this is why, as I said, the mission is so critical, because it's a journey. You've got to understand your motivation of why you're doing this. Mm. And if it's to make money and make a quick buck, you're not going to be the right person to, you know, build a new category of business or a network business. I think, as we mentioned earlier, you know, it is all about storytelling. Yeah. I think one of the probably the most valuable tools I have, both internally and externally, is our vision deck. And all this is actually quite simple. It's a story of an individual who is using our technology in, we do it in 5 years' time and we do it in 10 years' time.
I've seen it, it's good.
And I think suddenly it paints a picture of what life should be like when this problem is solved at scale and this new category that doesn't exist is in full form. And I think that was a very powerful tool that I had. And not only just to get investors on board, but actually working with investors. I remember really clearly there was a bit of a, we were going through the accelerator program with 54 Collective and they were really trying to understand our business. And there was a bit of a disconnect because I think they thought we were more of an identity business, et cetera, rather than a platform play. And it was only when I presented this deck that kind of a number of weeks of confusion suddenly just instantly created clarity that, oh, okay, this is where they're going. Now we can understand it. So it comes back to storytelling. And definitely would advise people to create that story because actually it's probably one of the most fun, enjoyable pieces of the job as well.
Yeah, I love that. And one of the things that oftentimes we do with founders is what we call like a wiki page where essentially it's like writing out the vision of what you see the company being 10 years out, because sometimes you can get so caught up in the day-to-day needs that you kind of miss out on what the bigger picture is, right? I'm just curious, like as you've gone through this journey now, entering that 10th year, what were the key moments where you kind of thought to yourself, like, wow, this is like a real challenge and you've overcome it? I'm just always curious to hear some of these moments because oftentimes we hear the highlights, but I'd love to hear, was there any moment where you and the team thought down?
I mean, a lot.
We get this so many times, like, which one do you want, yesterday's or like 10 years ago?
There's different levels of existential sort of challenges. I think I've never doubted the mission and the need for this business to exist. And that is fundamentally because it's focused on a problem and the problem still hasn't been solved. And it comes back to what I said before. So as long as the problem is still there and it's not solved, this business needs to exist. And I think that means that whatever is coming, whatever's been thrown, whatever challenges there are, it's like, no, we just have to keep going. There's a great clip from a YC partner that I played actually to our team at a quarterly offsite. And he's like, you know, people think at YC, I give lots of amazing, like genius advice. He's like, I give one of the most basic fundamental pieces of advice is like, just don't give up. It's like, that is it. If you give up, if you stop, then you're out of the game.
Yeah, just stay alive long enough. Yeah.
You know, I think probably one of the most challenging moments was when we had actually built quite a successful product that was working well with delivery businesses. We had a few hundred thousand users in Kenya using it. We were making some money, but we were struggling to scale to the next level. Partly because of the businesses, partly because of the unit economics. And it was also proving a little bit more challenging to raise. We're in a mobility space, which generally was not very hot at that time. Yeah. And then COVID hit, and you know, that was the point when we actually pivoted from selling these accurate addresses to delivery businesses in Kenya to saying we're gonna go and sell verified addresses to financial services in Nigeria. And that was a big bet. But actually, it was very scary, but it's also very motivating. Because suddenly we're like, you know what? This isn't working, we've tried. There's a shift, we need to make a shift. And we just went all in. And it created, as much as it was probably the most challenging point in the company, it changed, created this whole shift in energy. And everyone had this like new space to focus on.
I was gonna ask, but I think you've touched a little bit on it, on if there have been any events that have been an accelerant or like an existential threat to the business. And one we hear a lot of is COVID, and it goes both ways. Some people are like, oh my God, we almost died. Some are like, oh my God, that was when we had the, you know, massive growth. Have there been any other things aside from COVID? Maybe you can throw more light on that. Maybe regulation or anything that just created an inflection point that you probably couldn't have predicted, but ended up being like a key lever to the next phase of the business.
Regulation has been an interesting one to navigate. Okay. I think when we moved to this financial service space and seeing that a verified address was needed, you know, when we spoke to the central bank in Nigeria, they're always very supportive. In fact, they've actually been very collaborative and totally got what we're doing, could see the impact that we could deliver to the Nigeria economy, and were like, we totally support what you're doing. We're like, great, can we put this in writing? And they're like, we can't, because address verification isn't a licensed space. And if we do that, then we have to do this for every address verification business, and you're not regulated or licensed, so we can't do this, which is understandable. But then the big banks, the more risk-averse banks, were like, well, before we go and integrate your service, we want to make sure that if the regulator does come, that your proof of address is recognized. So can we have this in writing? But they said it's fine. They're like,
that's
might need that a little bit more details. So that has been a tricky one to navigate. And earlier this year, there was interesting moments with the central bank, and we now have the written approval from the central bank, which is the first time anywhere in the world that now has supports digital address verification. And that has led to pretty much every single major bank and fintech signing up, and we've won almost every deal in the last like 4 months since that
Amazing. Yeah, this is interesting, because I think that you brave founders who go to the markets that are unclear, I'm just like, I don't know how you do it, because I really think that founders in a sense are prophets. You somehow see intuitively what the world is optimizing for, is getting to, but because the world is a moving organism, you know, you collapse space and time in your mind. On a first principles basis, you know that it's coming. You know that it's a problem that needs to be solved, but the market is moving, and you always need to iterate to figuring out what expression in what version of the market makes a business make sense. I would love to talk about how you manage your team, especially with a vision like this. How have you navigated, you know, putting a team together with a culture that kind of cements the fact that we are solving a very painful problem that's a massive market that we probably even couldn't predict the size, because it didn't exist. Like, there's nothing to point it to. But how do you think of culture? How do you think of team motivation? How do you think of all of that in the context of the team?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I'm like, I feel very lucky and fortunate with co-founding and the team that, you know, I have, and that we work together every single day. I think there's three parts to this. We've spoken about two of them. The mission, which is like why the companies exist. The vision, which is like, what is the company going to be like in 5-10 years? And then the third part is the culture and values. And we work hard at the beginning to define the culture and values of OK Hi, which has enabled us to hire people that align with that. And I think has created an environment where, because we've hired against it, the people that when they do join, it's a fit.
Yeah.
Or if it's not a fit, it's quite obvious quite early on.
Yeah.
And once it is a fit, then you know, ultimately there's a lot of alignment. And yeah, it's something I'm very passionate about, something as co-founders we work really hard to keep working on and instilling.
I think culture is one of these really interesting things that oftentimes it's an afterthought, and when it is an afterthought, it become very difficult to try and
reverse a culture
creation.
Totally.
So yeah, I'm just curious how you went about doing that.
And the more tangible, the better, because it's also ephemeral. Okay. Everyone says culture, like what does it mean?
I think Brian Chesky of Airbnb is probably one of the best people to talk about this. So I would highly recommend people look him up and the sessions that he runs or talks about it. And really sort of coining his philosophy, it's like the culture is the unique DNA of the company. And initially that's driven from the founding team. Very important that the culture, and which is sort of manifested in values, isn't what you want the company to be. Then it's failing because you're aspiring to do something, but it is what is already in that. And that comes from the collective founders. And so there's this brilliant exercise that I kind of found randomly online and was a little sort of apprehensive about putting this quite sort of
untested
felt quite sort of American sort of wishy-washy thing. And I turned up at one of our quarterly retreats with there was like five of us, and I was like, we're going to try an exercise, and it's really powerful, and I'll send a link so you can put it in the notes.
Yeah, we'd love that.
But basically what you do is, as an individual, you go away and you plot on a graph where x-axis is the time of your whole life, and y-axis is what's been like really highly impactful in a positive way and negatively. And you plot the 10 biggest moments in your life. Then you sort of annotate that to what were the biggest sort of learnings and takeaways from those moments. And it's interesting because from an individual perspective, these are things that actually are inherent in us, but we probably not necessarily that conscious, but invariably the whole sort of psychology is that these biggest moments are what kind of really make these informative sort of values that we live on. So you basically end up as individuals with these key kind of moments, but also takeaways and your individual values. And then you come together, you talk about those values as a collective group, which is an amazing experience because you get to know each other better.
Because I was about to ask, it's like very personal.
A lot of personal, so people don't have to share it with them, but like it's amazing when you do. And then out of that, you find what are these unique collective traits that you kind of commonly have together that creates this unique DNA as people, how you live and how you want to be and how you are. And that then enabled us to form our five core values, which we set 10 years ago, and we live and breathe every single day.
You know what I find interesting about that approach? It's the fact that culture starts forming before it does, and you hire people against it, but it's often not clear. So you're using that exercise to almost synthesize what the culture really is, to put a mirror to it and then codify it. That's interesting.
Which is very important, because otherwise you're relying on your sort of basic
projections
can be like subconscious bias. And because this person looks or sounds or seems similar to you, you're like, I like them and therefore they're aligned with my culture. But actually that's the values, that's not actually true. Find people ideally that are quite diverse from you to create those different experiences and thoughts. But you have the common set of values to make sure that culturally you're aligned.
Got it. Interesting. Okay.
Just thinking more broadly about team, what have been some of your key learnings about building a team over this 10-year journey?
One of the things I interview as CEO of every single person that comes in is how mission-driven they are. And so they've got to be bought into the problem. And if they're not,
it's probably very important, like for your type of business.
Totally, I would say any type of business. Yeah. You know,
but like practically speaking, how do you go about assessing that?
It's actually quite simple. I basically ask them two questions, which is like, what is our mission?
Oh, that's anyway, obvious.
It's on our website.
The website. At the very
if they have a look, then flag.
And if they can't articulate it or whatever, then I'll explain what it is. And then the second question, which is more important, is what does this mean to you?
Mm-hmm.
And then you very quickly get a sense of the depth of this.
Yeah.
And if they're just doing this because this is a tech startup job that they might have read online, there's no depth to it. Suddenly people will start talking about their own personal experiences and why, whatever, and suddenly you're like, okay, this person's there.
Did you come up with that?
Huh?
Did you come up with that? It's very clever, like very simple.
I presume.
No, but most people don't. I think like it's such a great way to understand if someone understands how you view the world, like what you're trying to achieve as a business, and also their personal expression within it, because that's probably the depth to which they'll be committed.
Totally.
Or they would bring their full selves to the table.
The other hiring hack I have, aptitude is obviously something that you want to hire for, very difficult to test. Yeah. I find the most effective way of doing that is I start off the interview by just saying, what questions do you have for me?
Oh, wow. Okay. So turning it on his head.
Because usually you've got questions at the end, there's not enough time. It's like a giveaway.
And then you only get time for like one or two questions.
You very quickly know how thoughtful someone's been about the business and whatever, about the questions they ask. And so I find that is a very highly correlated signal to how they think, how deeply they think. Because someone who has high aptitude, who's into the business, has a lot of questions. And the best interviews for me are when I don't even ask my questions and they just ask all the questions. I'm like, great.
I love that.
I love it. One of the things we tend to ask, especially just to be in a retrospective or reflective like position, is if you could go back, are there any things you would do differently? Are there any things you would... And I'm sure maybe there are a few, but like maybe pick one or two that in retrospect you wish you thought of differently. And you know, we can't rewind time, but if you could go back in a time machine and kind of like give yourself that tip, it would have helped. If you could share that with someone out there who may be listening and needs that too.
I would say one of the surprises that I still have is that like every week I'm still learning about the problem. We ended up pivoting the business to, you know, solving the problem of for financial services and the proof of address. But that was 4 to 5 years into the business. We knew it was there and I had some early discussions, but I didn't really understand the depth of it. And so one of the key things I would do is spend more time understanding the problem and the customer. So you really have more depth and breadth than I think everyone's itchy to solve it and jump in and build or whatever. I don't think that you can spend too much time
on the
focusing on it. I mean, you know, our problem is pretty unique, and not unique, but it's so big and it's so broad. But I think we would have moved faster as a business if I spent more time in that space. The second one came into my mind. I think there's an interesting space around people, and there have been times when I have felt that something's not quite working and had conversations with an individual or whatever around this, but hadn't necessarily acted on what ultimately was not a fit. It did happen.
Yeah.
But you hear it time and time again. I think that instinct has proven right. And when that person has left, as much as you think that there's going to be challenges or whatever, like it's been, that instinct was right. And I think there's a lot to be said around finding and setting up, I would say almost to what we talked about, which we don't really do, setting up these, you know, short-term things and making sure that whatever that is, the initial, you know, 3-month onboarding period or beyond, is sort of set up for people not to make it. Or if things do change, for that to move. And I think it could definitely be more like, not just instinctive, but like stronger in terms of actually making those hard decisions.
If you weren't building OK Hire, what would you be doing?
Oh, I'd be doing the neobanking thing.
Really?
Like, banking has always been, I remember when I started at Google in product marketing, I shifted to being a product manager, which was like another 10 rounds of interviews, even internally.
Yeah.
And they were testing for like my sort of, I suppose, problem product instinct. And they were like, what problem frustrates you? And I'm like, banking. And I'm like, don't get me started.
We will not leave this room.
Don't get me started on banking. Yeah. And so it's been interesting and rewarding to see how these neobanks have come on board and disrupted the banking industry, because I still think there's lots of way to go, but that would be the space.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both. Thanks for having me.
Leave a review. Tell us what you think of this episode on all of our platforms at the Startup Leap Pod. Do you have a question? Ask us and we'll ask our guests. Go to thestartupleap.io. See you next time.